Good evening. Good to be with all of you again. We're going to be doing something a little different tonight wouldn't be characteristic of what we did this morning or what we're going to be doing for the rest of this week. But when Samantha and I first moved from San Diego to Atlanta, I was worried going back to the South because we had lived in Nashville before. I was worried that I wasn't going to find a lot of people who knew they weren't Christians to study the Bible with. Evangelism has always been something since I've become a Christian that I think is very critical for a lot of reasons. It's something God's told us to do. It's something that as an evangelist, I should be evangelistic. There's a lot of reasons for it. But when I moved to Atlanta, I started a meetup group specifically for atheists, so that I would be studying with people who knew that they weren't Christians. The dividing line between being a non-Christian and then becoming a Christian was going to be clearer. And I grew up in a family that didn't believe in the Bible. We wouldn't have, I think, disbelieved in the existence of God, but we wouldn't have trusted whatever the Bible said. And we never really took God seriously. And so starting a group like that fit my background to some extent. And so I did a lot of research in getting those studies ready. And I made some mistakes the first way that I tried approaching those studies, and then I learned some things that I don't think I'll ever forget in how I engage with skeptics. So what I want to do in this lesson tonight is give an overview of the approach that I've learned to use when studying with skeptics. But this isn't just like a, hey, go talk to your neighbors like this, although you could do that if you wanted to. I want all of us to be challenged in this lesson in some ways that I think we need to think more about for our own faith anyways. So my hope is that this lesson tonight will accomplish several things at one time. I want to begin though with some statistics about skepticism in our culture right now. And by the way, I've heard that Bowling Green is the fastest growing part of Kentucky right now. That's true, isn't it? And there's probably a lot of people moving from areas that were not very religious. There's probably a lot more skeptics moving to a place like this right now than there ever has been before. But I want to show you some things about some statistics that are true for the United States. These statistics that I'm about to show are not true for countries outside of the United States. Religion is on the decline in America, but it's on the incline in other places like China and Africa. But a couple years ago, Pew Research, back in October 2019, they did some research finding out who the non-religious people were in our society. And that is broken up into atheist, agnostic, and unaffiliated, just people that are not religiously interested. And in 2009, in that same research, they compared from a 2009 poll that they did, that 17% of the United States population was non-religious. But then in the newest one that they did in 2019, that number had jumped up to 26% non-religious people. Now, from that point, 2019, you go just less than 2 years, Gallup poll did something in March of 2021. And in that research, they found that for the first time in the United States, less than 50% of people belong to a church in the United States. And they said in this article that the decline in church membership is primarily a function of the increasing number of Americans who express no religious preference. So this is a really scary thing. So look at all those numbers and be really scared. Okay, are we all scared now? All right, so we're scared. So what's the reason for this? Why is it the case that in the United States, there's less and less people that are interested in religion? And I remember when I was growing up, I had some friends that were atheists, and they showed me a bar graph that showed me the higher educated somebody is, the less likely they are to be religious. In other words, they were saying, okay, so if you're smart, you're not going to be religious. Because the smart people have looked at the evidence, they've looked at what science has said, they don't need the crutch of religion anymore, because science and those different fields that are associated with science have been able to answer the questions that we used to need religion for. And you had something like this from Richard Dawkins. By the way, when I study with the skeptics, I have read a ton from atheists. And I take quotes from what I've read from atheists and I use that for the discussion because they don't believe in the Bible. So I'm trying to use their people and get a conversation going from their people. Richard Dawkins is the angry English atheist, and he wrote a book not too long ago called Outgrowing God. And in the book, look what he says here. He said, outside Western Europe, where only a minority nowadays are religious, most people around the world still do believe in a god or gods, especially if they aren't well educated in science. You see what he's saying there? You guys, the ones in this room who aren't educated in science, you're probably the most devout in your religion. Because you're the ones who are not educated, but the ones who are educated among you are probably not going to be as serious about these matters because you know that we don't really need these things. You probably won't even come here very long anyways because you know better, is the idea. Now this is interesting to me because in the times that I've studied with skeptics, I begin my studies with atheists. We all go around the room. There's one time we had an ex-Muslim from Norway. We had somebody who grew up in a very Christian family that used to be like a youth minister that became an atheist. And like we had a bunch of different people around the table. And my first question to them is, what do you identify as? Not in the way that our culture is talking about those things right now. But I said, okay, what's your name and what do you identify as far as your worldview, your philosophy of the world? So I say, I'm Eric, I'm a Christian, and then so on and so forth down around. My second question is always, because a lot of people that I study with, they used to be religious in some way, and then they got rid of religion. And so I'll ask them, what made you get rid of religion in your life? And most of the time, it's not because of being enlightened in some kind of higher way of thinking. Most of the time, the reason for their unbelief stems from some kind of an emotional reaction against what they experienced growing up. So it's interesting that on the one hand, the skeptic today says, well, we have reached higher thinking. Okay, that's good for you. What led to you being an atheist? And they get really angry and there's emotional things behind it. I want to show you some quotes, or at least one of them. There's an atheist named Aldous Huxley who wrote a book in 1937 called Ends and Means. And in the book, he explains why he became an atheist. So look at this quote. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness, in other words, the world has no meaning, there's no God that you have to answer to, so there's no such thing as ultimate meaning in life. The philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. Does this sound like enlightened thinking to you? Or does it sound more like, well, if I have to accept what the Bible says about things, then there's certain desires that I would like a free pass to fulfill that I might as well just get rid of the whole system and then I'll be able to live how I want to live. Okay, so sometimes people want to have an excuse for sin and that's why they get rid of their religion. That's not every atheist, though. That's some of them, clearly one of them. Another reason is bad religious experience. This is the most common thing that I've run into when I've studied with skeptics. Is I'll say, okay, tell me about your religious experience growing up. Mom and dad were hypocrites. They made me come to church all the time. They never lived it out. They were constantly angry. They weren't loving anybody else. They tried to put on a good show in front of everybody, but then at home, the home life was totally a wreck. Why would I want to take that seriously? Or peer pressure. Imagine that you are part of a college cohort and you're taking marine biology as your degree. I don't know. And the people that you are taking all these classes with, are you going to fit in very well if you're the one that keeps going, I believe in God. I believe in God. I believe in God. You're going to be like the most unpopular loser in that cohort of people. Do you suppose that that kind of peer pressure could cause people to go, oh yeah, it's actually enlightened thinking. That's what it is. When really what's behind it is more peer pressure than anything else. All of those things are emotional things. So when the skeptic today says, okay, the reason that you're a Christian is because you've got emotional reasons for your belief. You can't stand the thought of not being with grandma one day or something like that. So you need to have this emotional crutch, but we have reason. Look at the reasons why a lot of people are skeptics. It stems from an emotional thing. Now, okay, The first time I had a study in Atlanta with atheists, I started out with the first class was, here are the evidences of the resurrection of Jesus. By the way, is that an important topic to study? Very important. I was studying with a guy who grew up with a very bad religious experience. And so when we talk about meeting people where they're at, you heard people talk that way in regards with evangelism, that when we study with people, we got to meet them where they're at, meet them where they're at. Okay. Am I meeting somebody where they're at if I'm coming in with objective archaeological evidence for the Bible, with objective logical arguments for the existence of God? That's logic, which we need that. But if they're starting with an emotional thing and I'm not meeting the emotional thing that's going on with their unbelief, I'm not really meeting them where they're at. Do you see what I'm saying? And so what I started to have to do is try to figure out a new approach to studying with skeptics. Most people make decisions based on emotion and not logic and rationality. Not everybody is Spock. And so if we're studying with people and interacting with people that might present themselves as being very logical, but there's a lot more emotional things behind the rhetoric that they're giving, here's the question. Can Christianity have an emotional appeal to people? That if you clear away the emotional barriers, yeah, now let's talk about the archaeological evidence, now let's talk about the more classic, what I like to call objective evidences for the faith. What I do in these studies is what I like to call subjective evidences for the faith. There's things within you that you know you need. And when you think about your secular worldview without God, you have to ask yourself, does your worldview without God provide for you the things that you know you need? Now, we're going to do that exercise with four different needs. That's the approach that I take, though. And so let me show you the first of the four needs that I discuss. By the way, I'm going to do four things. When I study with the skeptics, we go like to seven different needs or something like that. Where what we do is we say, okay, we have a need for community. We're not going to talk about community tonight, but we have a need for community. How does the secular worldview give you a sense of community versus how the biblical approach gives you a sense of community? Which one is more emotionally appealing? You see the exercise. So let's start out with our need for meaning. Everybody, whether you're a Christian, atheist, whatever, would say that you need to have some kind of sense of meaning in life for your life to have any sense of satisfaction. And meaning in life looks backwards to why you're here. What are my origins? And then what am I going to leave behind after I'm gone? We want to know that what we do counts forever. Now, if somebody is charitable to the secular worldview and you ask the question, if I was an atheist, how would I try to find meaning in life? And really try to think, how would a skeptic try to find meaning in life? Here's one quote from an atheist named Adam Rutherford, and he says this, a meaningless universe, again the idea that there's no God that we have to answer to, so there's no ultimate meaning in life, a meaningless universe does not mean we live our lives without purpose. I'm an atheist, but I try to live my life replete with purpose. Be kind, learn, and discover as much as you can. Share that knowledge, relieve suffering when you can. Have tonnes, he's English, have tonnes of fun. That's why it's not pointless. Tons of fun. Here's what he's saying. Does this sound kind of like how people talk today? Hey, what's your meaning in life? Well, I don't believe in God, but I think that I can have meaning in life by being kind to others, helping where I can, pitching in the areas where people have need, relieving suffering. That sounds pretty modern with the way people try to approach having a sense of meaning. All right. Now, whenever we study these things with the skeptics, we take one of these things and we study it for like an hour and a half. So I'm going to be really quick on these things. But what's the problem with this quote? There's a few problems with this quote. Number one, look at what he's saying here and ask yourself the question, what kind of person can this apply to? The only kind of person that this can apply to are people that have privilege and wealth. You want to go to a really poor person in India? who's got nothing. And the person goes, hey, like, I'm really in need. I need to have a meaning in life. And Dr. Adam Rutherford goes, okay, all right, Mr. Guy that has no legs and you're looking there asking for handouts and things like this. You have legitimate needs. Here's how you find meaning in life. Have tons of fun. And relieve suffering. Learn whatever you can learn. This worldview cannot apply to most people in the world because most people in the world don't have the kinds of riches that this guy takes for granted in this quote. If this is your philosophy on having meaning in life, your philosophy can only apply to what, like 2% of the world's population, and therefore it can't be a good worldview. So that's one problem with this. But here's the second problem. Let's say that my meaning in life is to have tons of fun, and the thing that gives me tons of fun is my work. I have a lot of meaning in my work. But then my company goes under. Or let's say that my meaning in life is my family, and I have a lot of fun with my family, and I love my family, and we help each other and all these things. One car accident can take away my meaning in life, can't it? If my meaning in life is something that's in this world, suffering and trials, tragedies can just remove it in an instant. So it's very fragile. It's going to leave you broken because it's going to be removed from you one day. So that's a quick way to deconstruct that. But think about what the biblical worldview is in contrast. So if that's how a secular person might try to find meaning today, what would be the biblical worldview? Well, the Bible teaches at the very beginning that we are made in God's image. This is an interesting word here. In Genesis chapter 1, when the Bible says that we were made in God's image, can you think of how the word image is used in other places in the Bible? Like when the Israelites are going to go into the promised land and the people living in the land of Canaan are going to have images to their false gods that you're supposed to smash and destroy. Same Hebrew word in some instances. And so God on the one hand says, make no images of me. By the way, if my image of God was a bull with big horns, what would that emphasize about God? His power. Well, what if one of you said, well, my image of God is a lamb. Okay, well, you miss the power and you emphasize his tenderness. Do you see how one image can't really define God because God is multifaceted and he's a complex being. So one image can't define him. So God says in the Bible, don't make any images of me because I've already made images of myself all across the world. They're called human beings. There's only one thing that God made that's dignified and able to be something that images him or gives you a picture of who he is. And those are people made in his image, which is everybody. It doesn't matter what skin color you are, doesn't matter what economic status you are, doesn't matter what country you're from. Everybody is made in God's image, which means your choices have an eternal impact. If the spirit he gave to you is going to go back to be with him, every single thing that you do matters because there would also be a judgment day. Okay, consider this though. If one of the problems with the secular worldview in finding meaning is that suffering can take it away. Trials can take it away. Can suffering and trials take away the purpose of the Christian? 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 and 21. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. You see here that Peter is saying, when you suffer on account of being a Christian, this does not ever take you away from your meaning in life. It actually drives you deeper into your meaning. So if your meaning in life is reading, but then you lose your eyesight because we live in a broken world, your meaning has been taken away. If you're a Christian and your car breaks down or you lose your job or something, none of it can ever strip you away from your meaning in life. And so that's the first need, is our need for meaning. By the way, just as a challenge to us, are you finding your meaning in life in God? Or functionally speaking, are there other things that you rely on more for a sense of meaning than God? Notice the next need is our need for an identity. There's a couple of ways that you could think about what identity is, but all of us have different hats that we wear. So like, I'm a father, I'm a preacher, I'm a husband. I don't know why I did that. I'm a son, We all have different things that we do, and depending on what hat I'm wearing in the moment, we act a little differently. Not because we're hypocrites, but because we're trying to fit the role that we're involved with. So like whenever I'm talking with Samantha, I don't get up and like in the living room and like tell her to sit down and start listening to me because I'm a preacher. That'd be really weird. Your identity is whatever is identical about you in whatever hat you wear. So there's a core you that's identical in every circumstance. Having a sense of identity is something that different cultures have tried to instill in people and have different ways of trying to cultivate it. I want to compare and contrast the ancient and the more traditional or the more modern approach to identity. Traditional approach to identity works from the outside in. What this means is that if you were, let's say, growing up in the 1500s and daddy was a carpenter, what are you supposed to be? A carpenter. Well, what if you really want to be an artist? Sorry, you can't do that. You got to be a carpenter like dad was. So what happens in the traditional approach is you take your own desires and you stuff it and you just toe the line of what's expected of you. The modern approach is exactly the opposite, where we go from the inside out, where I start with what I think I am, and then I demand that all of you celebrate it and are happy with it, and if you have any problems with it, we're going to stuff you into submission. You're the one who's got to stuff it, not me. You see that how very much that's our culture right now. By the way, the 2013 movie Frozen, very theologically rich movie, has the song Let It Go, very rich song. And in the song Let It Go, Elsa switches in the song from a traditional approach to identity to a modern approach. Have you ever analyzed the song like this? This is really great. Okay, watch this. So in the first part of the song, don't let them in, don't let them see, be the good girl you always have to be, conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. What is she saying here? I've got things about me that I... Can you believe this came out in 2013? That's a long time ago now. Anyways, so she's saying, there's things about me that I've got to stuff that I cannot let other people know. And then the song changes and the colors change and all these things. And then this happens. Well, now they know. Let it go, can't it hold it back anymore? Let it go, turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. Do you see how the song switches like that? Have you ever analyzed this song? You let your kids sing it? He's switching from a traditional approach to this modern approach that says, I don't care what anybody thinks. The only thing I care about what's true about me, and you guys can just figure out how to deal with it. All right. This is the approach that our society's in right now, so this is the one that we're going to critique. What's wrong with this approach? All around us, people are saying, be true to yourself, be true to you. You better be true to yourself. And my thought about that is, I don't even understand myself. Like, have you ever had times where you had conflicting desires? Two things that you really wanted that could not coexist. So for example, you might want to be really successful in your job, and like, but it's going to demand that you work like 80 hours a week. But you also want to be a good family person, and you want to have kids, and you want to be there for your kids. Those are two desires that you have. Can they coexist at the same time? No. We constantly have desires within us that are conflicting, so when somebody tells me, be true to yourself, I feel like I change too much to know how to even do that. I had a friend in high school. His last name began with B-O-R, just like my name. So our lockers were always together. And so we would always talk. And he became like a youth minister at some church in Chicago or something. And we stayed friends on Facebook. But he became transgender. So he transitioned from being a man to a woman, grew long hair, got makeup, started to get some surgeries. We've kept in contact. But recently he detransitioned. Like his wife has taken him back. The confusion seems to have gone away to some extent. I've talked to him on the phone a couple times since his detransition happened. And I talked to him probably about a month ago now. And one of the things that he stressed is that when you're in this environment There's so many things within you that are constantly changing that when people are telling you to be true to yourself, how do you know how to do that in any kind of consistent way? We need a guiding North Star, and it can't come from whatever is within me because that can deceive me. By the way, another problem with this is that if this is incoherent because of my changing desires, this is also an illusion. Does our society really believe that we can all be true to ourselves? So I'm a Christian. You guys happy with me being true to myself? Is that being brave, being true to myself, being a Christian? No, our culture doesn't really believe that everybody should be true to themselves. What's the biblical approach, though? If there's one passage in the Bible that says something about forming identity in a biblical way that is concise, it would be 1 Corinthians 4. And in this passage, in the first four chapters, Paul is telling the Corinthian Christians, you guys are fighting over who your favorite preachers are, you guys are dividing up the church over your favorite preacher, and Paul's explaining in chapter 4, this is how I view myself, this is how you ought to view yourself, this is how we should think about identity. He says this in 1 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Notice here that Paul rejects the traditional approach to identity. He says, it's a very small thing that I'd be judged by you guys. I don't really care what you think about me. Okay? You might expect him to then go, I don't care what you guys think about me, I only care what I think about me. But did you notice that he doesn't do that either? Because in this text, he talks about how he doesn't judge himself in verse 4 and in verse 3. In verse 4, I'm not aware of anything against myself. In other words, my conscience hasn't been broken lately. I'm not aware of anything that I've done. But even in that case, this doesn't mean I'm acquitted. It doesn't mean that I'm innocent, because I could be misguided in my conscience. So I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what I think about me. Who does he care about? What the Lord thinks about him. And by the way, just insert everything that I talked about in the first sermon this morning, all the titles that God has given you. Do we need affirmation from the outside in? Yeah, but it comes from God. That's our need for identity. A lot more to say about it than what we're going to say tonight. The next need is our need for morality. I think everybody who is sane has a sense of moral obligation, where people would say that such and such is wrong for everybody. I don't think you're going to find anybody that says, well, you know, racism is wrong for me, but if you think it's okay, then that's okay. Murder is wrong to me, but if you think it's okay, then that's fine for you. There's certain things that people will say are just wrong for everybody. So the question is, which worldview gives people a better sense of where that moral obligation would come from? Before I say more about that, this is something that I've heard some Christians debate, and I think it's a silly debate. Can atheists do morally good things? Yes, atheists can do morally good things. So the question is not, well, you guys are atheists and you're immoral. No, the debate would be more this. How does your worldview get you to care about morality? What resources does atheism give you to make you concerned with helping the poor and helping the weak and all those kinds of things? So where does it come from in your worldview? And there's a couple approaches that a secular person would have. Number one, they might say that morality comes about from evolution. By the way, any college students here that have taken biology classes, raise your hand if you've ever heard anybody say something like this. Anybody ever heard this argument? Morality comes about from evolution? Okay, so I got a couple of hands. What people will say is, you see some animals helping other animals, like you see some monkeys helping other monkeys, and over the course of time, evolution kind of got perfected, and we started to develop these moral sensibilities because you can see it in some of the animals. All right, so that's what they would say. What's wrong with that? How about this first point? The strong eating the weak is pretty inconsistent with altruism. If your worldview says that everything has been the strong eating the weak, the survival of the fittest, we all descended from apes, therefore let us love one another. That doesn't follow. Your worldview is a brutal worldview. And somehow from that system has come about this belief in altruism. Now, when a skeptic, by the way, says that we Christians, we believe things on blind faith, and then we have the whole discussion about what faith means and all that sort of thing, does the skeptic have to believe anything by faith? It's a leap, not just of faith, it's a leap of logic for a skeptic to be concerned with altruism. I'm glad when they do, by the way, I'm not criticizing them for the fact that they do, but my question is, how does your worldview give you this concern? So that's one problem with this. But here's another problem. And this might be the most complex thing that I talk about tonight, and it'll just be really brief. Thomas Nagel is an atheist. He's a retired professor from NYU, and he wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos. And in that book, he talks about, he's criticizing his fellow atheists for using evolution to explain away everything. And he says that there's certain things that evolution could never have created. Look at what he says here. If evolutionary biology is a physical theory, before I keep reading, by the way, let me explain what he means by that. Evolutionary biology is a physical theory. That means that the only thing that's at work in evolutionary biology is chemicals and synapses. There's no God. There's nothing beyond what we can see. There's no supernature. There's no spirit. There's no soul. There's no God. There's no demons. There's no angels. It's all physical things happening. All right. So if evolutionary biology is a physical theory, as it is generally taken to be, then it cannot account for the appearance of consciousness and of other phenomena that are not physically reducible. Do you see what he's saying here? That if evolution is just a physical thing, how has it created things that seem non-material or non-physical? So if you think about a blue umbrella right now, is there one in your head? If you died the moment you were thinking about a blue umbrella and they cracked open your head and they looked, would it be in there? It's what you can think, your consciousness, this is a non-material thing that is tied to your brain, but it still has non-material properties to it. One of the non-material things that we all believe in would be right and wrong. Morally good things and morally bad things. How can a physical theory create the non-physical moral judgment? You can't do that. All right. Another idea is that morality comes from social consensus, but there's a lot of easy problems with that one, so let's move on. What's the biblical worldview? The biblical approach to morality would begin with understanding our purpose. All right, here's the clickatizer. You guys see the clickatizer? Let's say that I take this clickatizer, whatever it's called, made by Logitech, and I was going to go to some nails that needed to be pounded into a piece of wood, and I started using the clickatizer to do that. And the clickatizer shatters. So I call Logitech and I say, you guys make terrible clickatizers. And they say, well, what were you doing with the clickatizer? And I said, well, I was using it to pound some nails. And they said, well, that's not the purpose of it. So how can you judge something when you don't even know the purpose of it? Isn't it ironic that skeptics and atheists will say, oh, that's a good person, that's a bad person, this is morally good and this is morally bad, when you don't even know our purpose? You don't even know why we're here. So what gives you the right to know what's good and bad? The biblical approach, we're made in God's image. We already talked about that. But if we've been made in God's image, that means that our sense of right and wrong comes from God's character. We're supposed to image God. We're supposed to be pictures of God, which means what we think of as right and wrong flows not just from what he says, but his character. Because what he says comes from his character. And so the biblical approach has got a much clearer sense of how we know what right and wrong is. Okay, that discussion on morality is always one of the deepest ones, so let's draw back a little bit and finish with this one on hope. Everybody has some sense of needing hope, where every moment you live is lived in expectation of what you anticipate in the future. And in our society right now, our culture does not do a very good job of instilling hope. Every time birth rates go really down in a country, it's always because there's a lack of hope. Birth rates are really down. People would rather have dogs than kids. Suicide rates have gone up quite a bit in our society. Our society is not doing a very good job of instilling hope in people. But what would the skeptics today say? Well, this is how I find hope. This is what you'll find a lot of people saying. My hope is that I would like to leave the world a better place. And if I can, like, make some contribution in this part of the world that has problems, or in this area of the world that have got problems, then if I can get onto some cause, then I feel like my life has got a sense of hope, because I'm leaving something behind that'll make things better for other people. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 15 says, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." There are certain things that no matter what you try to do to help it, it will never really get better. You might make some contributions here and there and make things better for a population of people, that's fine. And insofar as you've helped people, that's been a good cause. But if your worldview still says that this earth is going to be destroyed by a solar flare or by a meteorite or something, and it's all going to crash and burn and there will be no more consciousness afterwards, what's the grand purpose of anything that you're trying to do to help anything? And maybe you could illustrate it this way. Let's say that you're on an airplane and it's coasting, but it's going to crash. But you all know you're going to die. So you're in the airplane, it's coasting, and you're headed towards a mountain. And you go, okay, well, I got 7 minutes. I'm going to go to the bathroom really quick. So you go to the bathroom, and the light in the bathroom's not working. So you get out and you talk to the steward person and you say, "The light's not working, the light's not working. We gotta fix the light. We have to make the plane a better place before it crashes." And everybody's gonna look at you and go, "You're crazy." If your worldview says this is all gonna be done anyways, why are you even concerned with making it a better place? Good question to ask. Another approach that people will say, that they try to use to get hope, is that you need to learn to accept death as a natural part of life. And if you accept death as a natural part of life, then you can embrace what will happen to your body after you die. This, by the way, this is going to become more and more popular. There's a lot of TV shows that are going under this way of thinking, very Buddhist. The Buddhist picture is that when you die, you're like a dewdrop going back into the ocean. Like, your body gets absorbed back into the earth, and you get to be part of that living thing. I read a book a little while ago by a woman named Catherine Osmond. And the book was called Grace Without God. And in the book, she's trying to explain how she finds meaning and purpose and hope without God. And at the end of the book, her daughter is asking her about grandma who recently passed away. And this woman has this, like, soliloquy that she does not speak out loud to her child, because she doesn't think her child is ready to hear what she thinks, but this is what she thought. "Our bodies decompose, falling back into the earth, merging with all other matter that makes up our planet. In the future, our decomposed bodies might provide nutrients to the trees. Someone might hang a swing from one of those trees, or sit beneath the shade of its leafy branches, or make a painted horse from its wood." Doesn't that sound nice? All right, when you die, your body could help fuel an oak tree, and somebody might hang a swing from that tree. Like, you don't know the possibilities of what your decomposed body could do. Somebody else could take that same tree and make a baseball bat and kill a bunch of people with it. You don't know what's going to happen. It's like you have to deaden something within you to be okay with that. But you find it, there's a lot of TV shows. Midnight Mass was one of the newer ones on Netflix that operated under this worldview. And it's becoming more and more part of our culture. Okay, so what's the biblical approach? The biblical approach to hope, 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 and 17. "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord." If Buddhism says that you're like a dewdrop going back into the ocean, just being absorbed by everything, that worldview implies that you stop being you. When you die, you don't have any consciousness anymore. You don't get to be you anymore. You just get to be absorbed into something. You notice that this text says, like, we who are alive will be caught up with them who are in the clouds. The biblical worldview is that after you die, you still get to be you, but in a perfected state. You never stop being you. But you get to be with them, in verse 17, with them. This means that in the afterlife, all of the Christians who have passed on that have meant so much to you and made such an impact on your life, you get to be with them forever. George Herbert was a poet in the 1500s, and he said that death used to be an executioner, but the gospel made him a gardener. Death used to be an executioner, but the gospel made him a gardener. You see all those graveyards, all the people that have been buried, there's going to come a day where they'll come out of their tombs, and there'll be this great reunion. But notice at the end of this is that they will always be with the Lord. The God of all comfort, the light of the world, the good shepherd, the refuge for the oppressed, the perfect father, the God of peace, the God of grace, the redeemer. You get to be with the God from whom all love emanates forever and ever and ever. And that sounds a lot better than my decomposed body feeding a tree that a swing might hang on. This lesson is not about just remembering all these quotes and stuff. My hope is that you've had some ideas of things that you could bring up to maybe some of your skeptic friends. Hey, have you thought about how you get meaning in life? Have you thought about the problems with that? Have you really thought through those things? Where do you get your sense of identity from? Have you realized how weak that can be and how fragile you might be? Have you thought about, like, why you care about helping the weak? I'm glad that you care about equal human rights, but have you thought about why you really do? Where's your sense of hope? Does Christianity have a greater emotional appeal? Yeah, Christianity can play the logic game. Look at all the arguments for the existence of God in the Bible. It can play that game, and it can play the emotional game too. And in our society, there's a lot of people that have emotional reasons for unbelief. And when I've studied with people and I've talked through these emotional appeals to Christianity, after we look at those things, then they're ready for the more classical evidences for the faith. And some of them have become Christians. The question for us tonight, though, is, are you putting your meaning in God? Is your sense of identity coming from God? Do you care about morality because of what God has said in his character? And is your hope really fixated solely on Jesus? If there's anything we can do for you tonight, we're about to sing the song, How Deep the Father's Love. As we talked about this morning, God's love is something that Paul prays for that the Ephesian Christians would understand deeper. When's the last time that you prayed that? If there's anything that we can do for you tonight, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.